ABC Listen. Podcasts, radio, news, music, and more.
Hi, and welcome to Country Breakfast. I'm David Claughton. And today we'll take a deep dive into the backpacker visa issue. The federal government has deprioritised that category of visa applications, and agricultural businesses say it's getting hard to find workers.
The government, they got to look out for us. You know, early in the year, we had early mangoes, and we end up competing with other country mango. They sell for a much lower price than what we can sell. If the government doesn't help us out to get a better source of labor or supply, then, well, you know, a lot of farmers are going to sell their land and they're going to go to something else.
Wayne Quach, who runs mango orchards in the Northern Territory. More on that shortly, but I'm joined by Callie Buchanan from the Bundaberg office of the ABC. Hi, Callie. What have you been up to?
Oh, I've been out to Taroom in central Queensland to go to the only show where you will see Texas Longhorns on display. The big boys.
So cattle with very big horns. That branch out like sideways. They're like a massive reach, yeah?
Yes, and I think the widest tip to tip that was on show in Taroom was 98.5 inches. To give you a sense, that's well over 6 foot.
Wow.
Which is well over 2 meters to do all the conversions. Maths is not my strength, but I think that 72 inches is 6 foot.
And they're not hugely dangerous because they're kind of pointy as well, aren't they?
They are pointy, and that is one of the big myths about the Texas Longhorn, because most people see them in the rodeo ring. It's a very specific animal bred for that kind of work. But they are essentially paddock puppies, but they do have a wide span, so you do have to be a bit more conscious, but they are beautiful animals in the paddock, and they handle very well. Lots of little kids handling the Longhorns, but I think that it helps that some of them were shorter than the cattle themselves, so they were out of the sweep zone, if you will.
That's an unusual approach to safety. Big and small. To rural news now, and a deluge of rain on the Western Australian south coast has damaged some valuable grain crops, Kelly, and washed out drains and roads on farms.
As Hopetown farmer Courtney Folds received up to 140 millimetres of rain across his properties in less than 24 hours and says driving around the farm is like driving through a river. He says some of the crops are lying down, but it's too early to tell the true extent of the damage.
I haven't heard rain like that. Usually you get big downpours, you know, and they're pretty short-lived, but that was, relentless for a good hour. It was 140 millimetres of pure runoff, really, so there's a lot of damage. Those pipes, drains can't handle that sort of volume. You know, they've swelled and the water's run off and done a lot of damage in low-lying areas around roads and any culverts around the farm. So, yeah, there's going to be a lot of washaways to repair once the crop comes off in October, November, some stage.
Yeah, the challenge of too much rain and things turning hot on the East Coast, Kelly. We're looking at some higher fire dangers coming into this weekend. The irrigation lobby group that was instrumental in that class action against the Murray-Darling Basin Authority, the Southern Riverina Irrigators, they haven't ruled out an appeal, but they didn't get the verdict they were looking for.
Yes, the group started the push for the class action and has been a large part of the case since its inception, but learned it had lost the New South Wales Supreme Court case and has been ordered to pay the Murray-Darling Basin Authority's costs. The chief executive of SRI, Sophie Baldwin, told Warwick Long it was a tough day, but there were some wins.
It will be disappointing, Woz, but look, I think one of the key things that came out of the class action was the admission by the MDBA that when they go over bank, they waste between 36 and 41% of the water volume. So, like, this is that's a significant admission, and with the continued push to relax constraints and flood private and public land, effectively every time they do that, they're going to waste that volume of water. So, you know, that's a really effective argument to move forward and say, hey, you know, this is supposed to be a basin plan and an environmental plan, and, you know, you want to waste between 36 and 41% of the water by flooding our farmers.
Still a big review of the Murray-Darling Basin plan coming in the next few months. And they've been ordered to pay costs, and they can be quite high. There was 28,000 farmers that joined that class action. Now, despite having one of the world's largest fishing zones, Australia ranks 52nd in the world for seafood production, Kelly.
Yeah, and a report from James Cook University has found that Australia imports about two-thirds of its seafood, which may mean that we're exporting our environmental footprint. Co-author Jonathan Smart says there are a range of reasons why Australia relies so much on imports.
Firstly, Australia actually has lower productivity in its oceans than some of the areas that we import a lot of our seafood from, and that comes from limited nutrient upwelling around the country. So our southern oceans are the most nutrient-rich, and that's where our largest fisheries are. So even though we have a really large fishable area around Australia, it isn't producing as much as it could be in comparison to other parts of the world. One of the other reasons is high operational costs. Most fish and chip shops are supplied by these small local fishing businesses that run on really tight margins. And those high operational costs, so fuel, increased costs of complying with regulations and management, they can be really restrictive and they can limit our local production, especially from small businesses. And we also have extensive management in Australia. So we've got a lot of licensing requirements, gear restrictions, bycatch reduction measures, spatial and temporal closures, and those are all really important for managing our fisheries and are necessary. But when they layer on top of each other, they can also really restrict fisheries production.
Yeah, like you'd think we'd be a huge fishing nation, but we're not. But one of the things I think we should look out for as consumers, Kelly, is that people are in food outlets now required to say whether it's Australian or imported seafood. So I reckon we should all look out for that. And Now to the banana industry. Devastating fungal disease is continuing its steady march across North Australia's banana farms.
Yes, growers in the Tully Valley in far north Queensland have been battling the severe fungal disease Panama Tropical Race 4 for just over a decade. And as Sophie Johnson reports, farmers are hopeful that banana plants that are resistant to the infection are on the way.
The soil-borne fungus can't be eradicated. Its spores survive for decades, and it targets the world's most popular banana variety, the Cavendish. The 11th and latest detection in far north Queensland is on a farm run by the chairman of the Australian Banana Growers Council, Leon Collins.
Yeah, it's hard. Some days you think you're fighting a losing battle. We knew it was going to come. One day it had to.
He says farmers are doing all they can to contain it.
Oh, we've been limiting traffic in the paddocks, tarping them up, blanking off roads, knocking out paddocks. It's a whole approach that we've using altogether. We've got to keep it refined to the Tully River system.
Nearby Tully banana farmer Adrian Creamer does not have TR4 on his farm, but says the threat is never far from mind. He says progress reports on the development of resistant Cavendish varieties are encouraging.
I was really, really happy to hear that research is getting done and there's possibly some varieties coming on the horizon that, they're Cavendish varieties that are totally resistant to Panama.
You'd have to hope so. Banana is one of the most popular things in the supermarkets these days. Now, southern rock lobster season, that officially opened yesterday. You can kind of feel the shift into spring, Kelly, certainly where I am in New South Wales. But that lobster region includes Victoria and South Australian coastal areas as well.
And while there was a lot of optimism when the ban on Australian rock lobster being sent to China was lifted last year, the local industry says the Chinese market has changed and prices are much more volatile. South Australian-based seafood retailer from Ferguson Australia Group, Andrew Ferguson, says competition in the Chinese market is a concern.
It's got so hard to predict now. 4 years out of the market's a long time and a lot of things have happened in China, as we see now. A lot more Canadian lobster, hardly used to see any of that product in there, and it wasn't really an important product. But so the Chinese have really learnt to deal with other product and got quite used to eating it. So it means that we've got to be very careful about the way we go about it compared to the previous years. And it almost seems as if at times you lose the market if you push too hard with our pricing, because it's easily replaceable from other parts of the world.
Let's hope they find a good market for their lobster. And it's papaya harvest season as well across the tablelands and the coastal regions of your state, Cali, far north Queensland.
Yes, Papaya Australia chairman and Mareeba grower Jared Kath explains how supply is tracking so far this season.
The tablelands is somewhat down compared to other years, but the coast is up.
What's caused those changes in volumes from the tablelands and the coast?
Papaya that you harvest today was... the fruit was set 6 months ago. That was determined by the previous 6 months. What happened the last wet season on the Tablelands, we had about 1.5, 1.8 metres of rain, which is well above average. The coast, they were tracking as per normal, where we were way above, which has greatly affected the production on the Tablelands here in the last 6 months. So supply has been ticking along quite in a sound position.
And finally, one of the country's most celebrated filmmakers, Warwick Thornton, is making his debut at a big RevHead event that's currently underway in Alice Springs.
Yes, Red Centernats has dozens of car and motorbike events across 4 days. I'm glad I'm not on the crew trying to polish them in the Red Centre. Warwick told Elsie Lang where he found the car originally.
I found it at Catherine's side of VRD under a big old mango tree covered in bat shit. And the old cocky who owned it, I said, you want to sell that old bull catcher? And he said, it's not a bull catcher, it's a bull chaser. And I said, yeah, but do you want to sell it? He went, yeah, nah. Anyway, I gave him some money that he was pretty, you know, he didn't smile, but I think he thinks he ripped me off. he was very happy with the amount of money I gave him for this.
That's a great story. I want to hear more about that. Warwick Thornton talking about the bull chaser. And you can actually search ABC and bull chaser and you can find Elsie Lang's story on the ABC Car Enthusiasm website. So I'll be heading out to the desert myself over the next 6 weeks, Kelly. So enjoy country breakfast in the meantime.
I will indeed. Stay away from those mango trees. Who knows what'll land on your vehicle?
I love mangoes, so that'll be okay. Thanks, Kelly.
Thanks, David.
Kelly Buchanan from our Bundaberg Bureau.
Australia's alliance with the United States has been the linchpin of our country's foreign policy for decades.
We value the unbroken friendship between the Australian and the American peoples.
But between the wars and the tariffs and the unpredictability, are we growing apart?
You know who else didn't help us? Australia.
Join me, Hamish McDonald.
And me, Geraldine Doogue, as we ask, do we still need the alliance?
That's all this week at 11 a.m, again at 9 p.m. on Radio National.
Anytime on ABC Listen.
To mining now, and Australia's exploration sector is going from strength to strength, with new data showing exploration spending for minerals was up nearly 4% and petroleum exploration up 24% this last quarter. As Tara DeLandgraf explains, the mining industry is anticipating a boom off the back of that exploration.
The Australian exploration sector is riding high. This week, the nation's Bureau of Statistics reported that mineral exploration spending was $1.14 billion for the June quarter, and that flurry of activity is being felt on the ground. For Kalgoorlie-based drilling company Top Drill, the demand for rigs has meant they're now working double shifts.
We're seeing the flow-on effects from Trump's behaviours and the gold price boom. So it's a real something that's real. We're seeing demand for outstripping our supply, so we're having to get innovative. So we're double shifting RC rigs, which historically haven't been performed, and that is part of the reason for the growth for our business.
And it does seem that some of that drilling is being co-funded, whether it's the EIS or the JEMI. I mean, are you finding that there is enough support, government support, for these explorers, particularly junior explorers, to actually get out there on the ground?
Yeah, I think the capital markets are really supportive of juniors and getting out there and finding the next mines of the future. The EIS system has been a great investment opportunity, and it's really supported some of those random holes that where they traditionally may not have gone for that risk profile. So no, EIS is great. I think the biggest challenge in front of the industry at the moment is the changes to the tax regime and capital gains tax. I think that impact will probably see a change of leadership, and I think they really have made it added uncertainty or challenges around why would you invest to give take on all that risk and then share 50% of the upside with the government.
That's Top Drill boss Tim Topham. As Tim mentioned, the heady times for exploration are being slightly overshadowed by planned changes to capital gains tax, which could make raising money for the sector harder. But Federal Minister for Resources Madeleine King says the sector is standing strong.
Exploration in Australia is at a remarkable point. We are finding out more of what we're made of right across this country, opening up new areas for that pre-competitive data exploration, This government has invested $3.4 billion into exploration. Mining companies have welcomed that. Exploration companies have most definitely welcomed that, and I've no doubt they'll continue to.
The Association of Mining and Exploration Companies is also concerned about the changes to capital gains tax impacting the exploration sector. But Chief Executive Warren Pearce says for now, money is still flowing into the sector.
It's been a good period for explorers in Australia. Capital finally came rushing back to the exploration industry sort of late last year. You sort of saw a lot of companies be able to step out, raise good capital through October, November and early into this year. And that's helped fill pockets. Essentially, that means that we're cashed up to actually undertake the exploration programs that will run for the next 18 months, 2 years. And that's a good place to be.
So is this cash actually going to get spent?
Well, I hope so. Got to get on the ground first and actually undertake the programs. It's always a long journey from discovery to production, and obviously exploration's pre-discovery, so we're working towards that. I think you're going to see record exploration expenditure probably the next couple of years. So we've sort of come off a little over the last couple of years from a peak maybe in 2023. I think you'll see it sort of plateau around there. But that's really substantial spend. You're talking a couple of billion dollars a quarter going back into middle exploration. That's good investment. Question is, where's that money going to go? Towards what kind of exploration commodities? How much of that's going to be pushed towards gold into brownfields? How much might go into critical minerals or other spaces, perhaps into greenfield areas or unexplored areas? So I think that one of the challenges we've got is gold price is going so well. There's a lot of people leaning towards gold. Lots of opportunity there. That's great. But it does mean that a lot of attention's fallen off some of the critical mineral spaces, some of the greenfields, unexplored areas, where you're hoping they might make the new big discoveries in copper or other critical minerals.
AMEX Warren Pearce. Well, the flurry of exploration activity comes as the Australian dollar gold price surpassed $7,000 an ounce for the first time earlier this year. So it's no surprise that much of the current drilling is in the gold space. The Australian Bureau of Statistics has reported that in the June quarter, gold exploration recorded the largest rise, up 23% to $565 million. A move that Shou Kai Fan, global head of central banks and head of Asia Pacific at the World Gold Council, says is great news for the sector's future.
I think it's really important. You know, the fact that gold has now become the number two largest export for Australia really reinforces the contribution of gold to Australia's economy, to jobs in Australia as well. It's the first time in multiple decades that gold has been in this position. And of course, it really resonates with the long history and legacy of gold in this country as well. So much of Australia is built on gold mining. So I think continuing to look for more gold deposits and resources is definitely a plus. It's also good because Australia is a very well-trusted source of gold. There's been a lot more focus on the provenance and how gold has been sourced, you know, whether it's been sourced responsibly. Australia has a stellar reputation in terms of its gold mining industry. So I think that there is definitely a plus to gold coming from Australia. So more of it would be better.
Shou Kai Fan from the World Gold Council. Well, many of the nation's gold explorers raised money back when the prices were high, early in 2026. And that means for now, their bank accounts are pretty healthy and drilling can continue, as market analyst Paul Howard from Canaccord explains.
I mean, certainly, look, the gold guys were smart. They raised capital in sort of beginning of the year, January, February, when the market was really buoyant. And they're excited now because they, you know, they might have come off a little bit, but they're still well funded. Like if I'm running an explorer, I'm not looking at my share price every day. That's sort of, if I've got good cash in the bank, it allows me to do my work.
For companies like Minerals 260, who are developing a gold mine west of Kalgoorlie and exploring for copper and gold near Moora, the current market strength is encouraging. Managing Director Luke McFadden says good exploration is what drives great projects, and that means wealth for the nation.
I mean, we bought 2.3 million ounces and now it's a 6.2 million ounce resource 15 months later. That's all through exploration. We've also been quite aggressive in the acquisition of tenements around Coolgardie too. So we've acquired about 1,000 square kilometres of exploration ground, and that's where we'll be exploring over the next 12 months too. Exploration in this part of the world is fantastic because it's historically mined. There's a lot of old pits around that we can go and drill. So we do see there's a lot of potential for further discovery.
How hard is it to get a drill rig at the moment?
It's okay. We haven't had too much troubles at all. At our peak, we had 11 rigs. We use several companies, so I think that helps de-risk our operations from a drilling perspective. But no, overall, it's fine. We certainly see a lot of potential going forward, that's for sure.
Minerals 260 Managing Director Luke McFadden. And you can read more about that exploration data online. Just head to the ABC News webpage. I'm David Claughton, and you're listening to Country Breakfast.
The federal government's pause on visa applications for working holidaymakers is hitting the ag sector hard. Backpackers make up half of the seasonal agricultural workforce. Petra Oates from the ABC's Mildura office in Victoria has been digging into the story. How are you going, Petra?
Hi, David. I'm good.
What are you seeing in terms of this story?
So I've been chatting to a lot of farmers and contractors and even some prospective ag workers who are overseas at the moment, and everyone is really, really concerned. There's a lot of workers in limbo as they wait for their visa approvals.
So can you explain a bit, though, what visas in terms of working holidays are we talking about?
Yeah, absolutely. So there's two different types of working holidaymaker visas. There's the 462 visa, which has a quota and is for countries like Indonesia and the USA. And Home Affairs, the Home Affairs Department has advised that this stream has been paused and they're not accepting new applications. There's also a 417 backpacker visa, which is for about 19 countries like the UK, Canada, France. The government is still accepting applications for this visa, but processing times are significantly delayed.
And have you spoken to any people trying to get into the country on a working holiday visa?
Yeah, I have. So I spoke to a UK farmer, Alex Coggan, the other day. He's in England waiting for his visa to be approved, and he's already done two harvests in Australia prior to this. So he's still waiting. It's been months since he applied, and he's just in limbo at the moment.
For the last 2 years, I've been on the working holiday visa. So this year, I have applied for my working holiday visa back in July. I'm now 6 weeks into waiting for my visa, due to come back out to Australia in 6 weeks, and I haven't heard a single thing about whether I'm getting the visa. And to put it into context, my first two visas, I got back within 20 minutes of applying. I know so many guys and girls that are coming across to Australia this season again, and they have applied the same time as me. Some people have had them back within an hour or two have been applied for. There's guys that are still waiting from June time. There's guys that are still waiting from May time for the visas to come back.
Wow, a lot of variation in terms of the responses. And you spoke to a harvesting contractor?
I did. I spoke to Matt Burke, who is a harvesting contractor. He works all up and down the eastern seaboard. He said he's never had issues with his staff visas like this. It puts their whole harvest at risk, and he is due to start in, about 4 or 5 weeks.
This harvest, we intend on employing plus 30 staff members. Out of that 30, I think there would be 60% come from overseas. And when I say overseas, that's out of Canada and England. Out of that percentage, there is probably 60 or 70% who have worked with me in the past. And I have significant concerns that they are not going to get their visas to come back into the country this year. I've never had this issue in the past. If I have, it would just be maybe a one-off. What has changed is the timing of the visas getting approved. So the staff that we're bringing in are super experienced, they're highly skilled, and they're extremely well paid. It's not unskilled labour by any means. So approval, I think out of 15 guys that have applied for their working 417 working holiday visa, not one working holiday visa has been approved yet. And some of these guys have applied early July.
Right. And this is the big issue in WA as well, Petra. They've got, up there, they've got the Pindan Beef Company, which is undergoing a massive rebuild.
Yeah, so it was mothballed in 2021, then purchased by Canadian investment fund AIM Co. in late 2025. The abattoir was scheduled to restart operations soon, but that was before changes to skilled work visa processing priorities came into effect. Now, Hayden Sale from Uella Pastoral Company, which is helping to manage the facility locally, says the opening date will have to be pushed into next year.
Pretty hard to open a plant. In fact, impossible if you can't get the labour to run it. So we're pretty much permanently on hold until we can solve that problem. So there's some pretty difficult decisions that have to be made this week. We've also got a whole supply chain behind that was lined up on the stations. We had about 6,500 cattle ready to process through late in the year that we're now having to find homes for that we've held on longer than we normally would have. We normally would have sold those through the middle of the year, probably at their peak condition. We've held them longer to facilitate the opening of the works. That's not happening now. So
where are the people based that you do have on standby ready to come over here and work in this abattoir?
So they're all in the Philippines at the moment. So at the moment we've got applications in for 29 skilled workers, and then there's 13 partners that would come with them. The partners are great because they come in and do the other jobs around the works and also work with the skilled meat worker people, like the cleaning up afterwards, the helping with cooking, general duties. And we've also paid $390,000 in visa fees to get those people in that are now just we're in a holding pattern.
Wow, it sounds like a financial and logistical nightmare for that company. And there's also a piggery in the south of WA that's having trouble finding workers. And also fruit growers and grain producers, they're worried that they won't find enough essential seasonal workers.
Yeah, Len Handersid grows strawberries at Forest Hill, which is between Mount Barker and Denmark. And he said he can't understand why the federal government is blocking people applying for working holiday visas.
There's no real reason that we can see for that. It doesn't impact on housing. They'll either stay in a backpacker hostel somewhere or have their own vehicle that they can accommodate themselves in and accommodate themselves pretty well, actually, most of the time. So it has a very minimal impact on housing. So they provide a service, a good, reliable service for those short-term crops. So I'm thinking of all those crops that might last for a month or 6 weeks and the job's done. Mine goes for much longer, but they come and help for that surge period in the middle of summer. So I can't see a reason, a reliable reason, why that would be an issue for anybody.
Might be politics. Look at what's going on nationally about that. And that's the rain on the roof at Len's place that you can hear there. So in Tasmania, a number of industries reliant on working holiday makers are also having trouble. That's infecting people in horticulture and dairy industries.
Yeah, Michelle Lawrence is a dairy farmer in Meander Valley, and she says finding locals to work in the dairy industry is just getting harder.
There is a shortage of skilled people in the industry. We've got three working holiday makers with us and an ag science engineer from Argentina that we're hoping that will arrive. His visa's taking a little bit longer than expected. It's really, really hard because we need these people on our farm. The working holiday makers that we've chosen, they're staying with us for as long as they can on their visas, as they can do in agriculture. That means that we can train them really, really well in preparation for calving season, which is really good for our cows, our calves and our business. So within that, we've got a skill set of science degrees, nursing degrees and electrical trades. So they're really strategic people on their farm and our farm.
Mm. And there's a view sometimes, I think, from the general public that these are just unskilled people that's picking fruit. But sometimes that's not the case. Now, it's also impacting people in the Northern Territory. Fruit growers there saying they're seeing less backpackers looking for work in that region.
Wayne Quach runs mango orchards in Pine Creek and Berry Creek. And he says since the end of the COVID pandemic, there's been a steady flow of backpackers looking for work. But that's dried up in recent months.
This year, we're thinking about $25, $26 a tray of mango. We're going to stop, let it fall to the ground. Because they're not economical for us. We may pick packs and then we send to the market and we take a net loss.
The WA Nationals have called on the federal government to speed up processing and end the pauses to working holiday visas. Would you like to see the NT government advocate for that as well?
I think so. We need this government to look out for us. You know, earlier the year, we had early mangoes and we end up compete with other country mango. They sell for a much lower price than what we can sell. If the government doesn't help us out to get a better source of labor, supply, then, well, you know, a lot of farmers are going to sell their land and they're going to go to something else.
So, Petra, what's the federal government saying about all this concern coming from the agricultural sector?
Look, David, not much. And there has been a lot of people that have gone to the federal government, gone to the Home Affairs Department, asking the questions, you know, why are there these delays? If there was a pause on one type of visa, why is this other visa being so significantly affected? And there hasn't really been many answers. It was about 2 weeks ago that Minister for Home Affairs, Tony Burke, made a press announcement, and he didn't even really touch on the pauses. He just said that there was going to be some delays in processing time. So it really hasn't been addressed, and it will be interesting to see if it is addressed. I think it's just a wait and see, unfortunately, at this point, for both the people that are looking on and the people that are overseas waiting for these applications to get on a plane and come start work in Australia.
Petra, thanks for doing a deep dive on the backpacker visas for us.
No worries. Thanks for having me, David.
Petra Oates from the ABC's Mildura office.
You're listening to Country Breakfast. I'm David Claughton. Still to come, we'll take you on a delivery run with an 80-year-old retired farmer who's found a new purpose in retirement, growing and giving away pumpkins.
You want a couple of pumpkins? Do you want a couple of pumpkins?
Pumpkins?
Yeah.
Thank you so much for that.
That's coming up on ABC Radio National. Let's go out back to one of Australia's most extraordinary landscapes, the undulating red sand of Central Australia's desert. And for four decades, one man, Don Rowlands, has been in charge of that area in Queensland. While tourists and travellers come to experience the world's largest parallel sand dune desert, for Don, the Simpson Desert has always been home. But today, Mr. Rowlands is preparing to retire and hand over responsibility to the next generation.
Arul, Anta Pedla, Don Rowlands.
Ranger Don Rowlands is the keeper of this desert, Mungathiri, big sandhill country.
Despite having to move on, my heart is still in the desert, and it is my traditional lands, and therefore I still have a responsibility to care for it, and I will. And no matter where the path takes me, I will always be walking in the desert. Get the job with the National Parks has given me the freedom to talk about my people in the desert. I couldn't before because for me to get work around here, I had to toe the line, and so I wasn't allowed to talk about my heritage, my desert.
For Don, Mungathiri National Park isn't just an office. It's tens of thousands of years' history hidden in the sand.
My grandfather, grandmother, and all the other families in town, they all lived out there. They lived in Birdsville and the desert.
When Don closes his eyes, the wind gives way to older sounds, feet dancing in the sand, the echoes of his ancestors, the Wonkanguru Yaluyandi people. He's spent a lifetime sharing his knowledge with all who come seeking to understand the desert, like me.
So Queensland's part of the Simpson Desert was declared a national park in the 1960s, and you were the first ranger put in charge.
Yes, I was privileged to be the first ranger in charge of, it's now called Mungathiri National Park, through a process with the department, but yeah, it's very happy and proud moment.
Every day has been a delicate balance of managing conservation, visitor access, and preserving culture. In 2014, native title of the Wonkanguru Yaluyandi people was recognised.
We just feel it important to get the land back because it's our heritage and it's our background. I think that's basically what we're saying.
That was Don back in 1995. He's no stranger to fronting the fight, and his work has placed him in a familiar space, navigating the ground between two worlds.
Most of my mob was so entrenched with growing up with white people that they didn't want to upset them, so I did a lot of the work by myself.
For 32 years, the quiet routine of putting on his ranger uniform each day gave Don a sense of pride and purpose.
The uniform is why I get up in the morning. I'm so proud of the uniform and what it represents to Queensland. It's the ultimate for me.
No one knows the desert like Don. He can distinguish every dune and reads the shifting sands like a map. He's been involved in dozens of rescues, many of those alongside Stefan Purcell, who was Birdsville's police officer for almost a decade.
Without Don, the rescues and just general travel around would have been near impossible for me. He just knew all tracks, all locations. Yeah, pivotal in the police work that I did to have Don with me.
At the Birdsville Hotel, Ben Fulliger reflects on how Don's retirement will leave a huge gap in the community.
We call on Don for usually around conditions in the desert, what the creeks are doing, what the floodwaters over the summer might be doing, just all types of local area knowledge. Just enjoy a little bit of downtime. But you will get a phone call when someone's stuck out there because we'll still be asking you questions.
Don has shared the stories, history and knowledge of this remote part of Australia with anyone willing to listen. His family is the reason he does everything.
That's one of my aims, to make sure my family don't disappear off the map. It's all about preserving my wife's story, my kids' story, but more in particular my story for them.
Through every success and setback, his greatest support has been his wife, Lynn Rowlands. She previously worked as a ranger with Don.
I was really proud of him to be wearing that uniform. When I had my uniform on beside him, I stood tall myself to be walking beside him after I kind of, and I know what he'd gone through and to, as growing up as a kid as well.
He may be hanging up the uniform, but there's still plenty of work ahead for Don.
Well, I don't want to stay at home and just do nothing. Toying with a few touring ideas and go off into some of this wild country, you know, like I want to talk about the bad times and also the good times, but the fight I've had in the middle to not erase the bad times, but to try and improve the good times and make it better.
Don Rowlands, Mungathiri Simpson Desert National Park, former ranger, ending that report from Hannah Walsh. So have you spent much time thinking about what you'll do in retirement? Well, here's one 80-year-old Queenslander who's passed his cane plantation on to his family, but he's still working the land in his own way. Amy Mitchell took a drive with Darcy Emerson, who keeps himself busy and his local Whitsunday community fed with a ute full of pumpkins.
Darcy Emerson's family has been farming in the Whitsundays for more than a century. He spent most of his working life growing sugarcane, and while he's officially retired, at 80 years old, he's found something else to keep him busy, growing pumpkins. And not just one or two vines, twice a week Darcy delivers around a ton of pumpkins to community groups, local businesses, daycare centres, doctors' surgeries, churches and charities.
Meals on Wheels, try and get them big ones. So, you know, they cut the whole thing up, and, yeah.
That's nice. Goes a bit further.
One day sort of thing, yeah.
Then it's round the corner to the local library. The Pumpkin Man, as he is affectionately known, is greeted by friends who recognise his ute.
Oh, yeah, I've bloody made it all.
Look at them all.
I'm that bloody big.
Indeed.
Thank you so much for that.
He asks for nothing in return but a thank you. Darcy, why give them away and not sell them?
I've got enough to live on and, you know, that's all I want and I just feel like I've got to help, you know, help people. That's what it should be all about, shouldn't it? Helping people.
At the Proserpine Community Centre, Community Support Officer Ashley Gunn greets Darcy with a hug.
Today we've got dancing, so a lot of them will actually take a pumpkin on their way out and then come back with extra produce that they've got out of their garden. So we've had bananas, lemons, limes. So it's sort of like a give and take system. And there's no judgment. We also put stuff from our community gardens on here.
Darcy's generosity has also inspired others. A local restaurant now uses his pumpkins and have named the dish in his honour, Darcy's Pumpkin Soup. And local mother Leah Warren is writing a children's book inspired by Darcy.
Just the generosity really touched me, and it is a value I'd like to instill in my family. And yeah, I just thought it was a message that needed to be heard. If it is made with love and shared with kindness, it is like planting a little pumpkin seed, and that kindness then gets shared multiple times over.
The final stop of the day is Darcy's favourite, the Endeavour Foundation in Cannonvale. Support worker Julie Harrison says the pumpkins are used by people attending the Learning and Lifestyle Hub.
So we've got our own garden out the back, growing all our own herbs. So we bring it in from the garden
and incorporate into our lunch.
And what do you cook with the pumpkins? What do you make here?
All the units make their own soups.
But just when I think the delivery run is finished, Darcy turns to me with another suggestion.
You wouldn't have time anyway to go out to the farm, would you?
No, I do.
So we head out to Kelsey Creek, about 15 kilometres from Proserpine. Darcy points out the hill where his father was born, the old school grounds he attended, and the hall where he went dancing on Saturday nights.
Yeah, good old days, ride a bike to school, you know. My dad and Uncle Murray used to ride a horse from the school, to school every day.
We drive past the house Darcy and Sharon built when their children were young, then through the cane paddocks to the pumpkin patch. Darcy grows bugle, butternut and Kent varieties using filter-press mud from the sugar mill.
How many do you reckon there'd be still in the paddock?
You'd have to get four, don't
they? Easy.
You'd have to.
Easy. Yeah.
Back home at the dining table, a family relic of its own, Sharon tells me Darcy often comes home talking about the people he has met.
He'll say, I met some lovely people today. He said I had a really good day. He's met caravan people, you know, and given them pumpkins and
keeps you occupied. Keeps me occupied, that's the main thing.
Yeah. He's gone all day most days.
Yeah.
As the pumpkin season comes to an end, Darcy assures me there'll be more pumpkins next year.
Darcy, how much longer do you think you'll be growing pumpkins for?
Oh, just keep going, eh? Hi. You want a couple of pumpkins? Hi. You want a couple of pumpkins? Yeah.
Thank you so much for that.
That's 80-year-old Darcy Emerson spreading the love and the pumpkins with Amy Mitchell in tow. This Sunday is Father's Day, and on a tropical fruit farm near Tully in far north Queensland, there's one very special dad getting ready to celebrate with his two adorable baby chickens by his side. Sophie Johnson caught up with Warren Orsman from Fruit Forest Farm to meet the orchard's resident father.
We're looking at our resident dad, Casaberry, and his two baby chicks that he's raising on the farm at the moment. They're in the Southsop orchard and they're just combing around looking for the ripe fruit that we haven't picked that's fallen onto the ground, and it looks like they're having a good feed at the moment.
Does this Casaberry dad, do you see him with little chicks every year?
Over the last sort of 5 to 7 years, he's always had chicks around with him. The female is on the farm and she's on a separate side of the farm. They sort of don't interact with each other, but most years he'll definitely have chicks on the farm, either two, maybe three, but definitely two, always walking around, and he always successfully raises them, so he's a very good dad.
Yeah, he's got two walking around with him at the moment on the hunt for a little bit of tropical fruit food. What's been their favorite, what's been their go-to that you've noticed?
Oh wow, well, Soursop's up there. I suppose they have a little Garden of Eden over here. Soursop, I saw him yesterday. He was having the ripe black sapotes that had fallen off the tree. He was having a bit of a feed of them over there. They'll go for pretty much everything. All he's doing at the moment, he's just looking at what he's got available on the farm. You know, a lot of bush tucker, but a lot of sort of farm stuff he can have access to. We won't necessarily chase him off or anything like that. A lot of the stuff that he's eating is stuff that's fallen on the ground.
What sort of impact does having cassowaries and then subsequently cassowary chicks on farm, does it do anything to, I guess, help the ecosystem here?
For me, seeing those cassowaries on the farm shows me that we're doing something right on the farm, that we've got a good balanced environment at the farm that they can move through, and they don't just stay on the farm. They've got their roots that they'll go through the rainforest and they'll work through where they're in the native bush tucker, and then they'll come through. So for them, they're spreading those natural trees, be it chukwandongs and whatever else, that they're putting through the rainforest. So it's establishing that sort of that biodiversity in the rainforest and including that. For us, realistically, they don't sort of cause too much of an issue. They're not spreading too many seeds across the place. And when they take the seeds, say they'll eat a soursop and they'll have the seed go through their system. If they go and do their business up in the rainforest, there's that much competition within that rainforest environment, lack of sunlight because of the canopy, they don't really sort of establish within their environment. It's mainly on the farm, yeah. That we don't have to really worry about them. They're great to see, great to look at, and yeah, we get excited when we see the little chicks running around because they're very, very cute. And he's a very good dad, very calm, won't bail you up at all. And yeah, and they created an interest. You know, people come here to sort of taste the fruits, but that's a sort of added highlight. You're lucky today that we actually found them, because as I was talking about earlier, The minute we walk out of here, they normally come out and have a run around. But today we're quite lucky we got to see them.
Tropical fruit farmer Warren Osman speaking with Sophie Johnson. To a small town show in Condobolin in New South Wales, which hosted their first ever scarecrow competition. And among the dozens of entries were a couple of tributes to Dolly Parton. A Dolly tribute wasn't the plan for the competition winners, but after she died, all it took was a quick costume change, some welding, some balloons, and Dolly the Scarecrow could make her debut. Reporter Emily Middleton spoke to Condobolin show committee member Lucy Manwaring about the background to the event.
So we're also celebrating this year, in addition to the 130 years, it's the International Year of the Woman Farmer. So we're having a scarecrow competition and in the theme of sort of the woman farmer. So you'll find all the scarecrows around. They're all in the theme of the woman farmer. We've got a nurse farmer scarecrow. And the most special one we've got actually is a Dolly Parton tribute scarecrow, that one champion scarecrow. So
amazing. And I've noticed that there's actually a second Dolly Parton scarecrow as well.
There's a couple of them, so that's exciting to see. I think they were both sort of really last minute designs, but yeah.
But you know what? It still made it, and they still won champion and first place.
Yeah.
Made by some young people out there.
I got the chance to catch up with the masterminds behind the Dolly Parton scarecrow that won grand champion at the Condobolin show, Fred and Max Gunn.
Hello, I'm Fred, and I'm 8 years old. Hi, I'm Max Gunn, and I'm 10 years old.
Beautiful. And so these are the masterminds behind the Dolly Parton scarecrow. Can you tell me a bit about the makings of her?
So we filled her up with baling twine, and I did my first welding job to make the frame for her.
How did you go with that?
Good.
Have a bit of help from Dad?
Yes.
And what was your idea behind the Dolly Parton scarecrow?
I didn't have much, but we went through a lot of balloons.
Where did the balloons go? Fair enough. And
I kept popping because Dad was too cute.
And so I heard that it was a bit of a change of events. It wasn't originally meant to be Dolly Parton.
We were just making a normal scarecrow, but when we discovered Dolly Parton's died, we made it of her with a guitar.
And are you big fans of Dolly Parton?
Not really.
Not really?
Yes,
not
you really. Are, Fred!
Well, I never heard her.
Oh.
So what made you change your mind to go with Dolly Parton?
Because she sang a couple songs that a lot of us like, and it's a good way to commemorate someone.
What's your personal favourite Dolly Parton song?
Jolene, fortunately.
Same as him, that's the only one I know she sang. Oh, now I remember it, Stumbling Out of Bed.
9 to 5?
Yeah.
That was 8 and 10-year-old brothers Max and Fred Gunn, ending that report by Emily Middleton. And finally, to one of the country's most celebrated filmmakers, Warwick Thornton, who's making his Revhead debut at a big event that's currently underway in Alice Springs. Red Centre Nats has dozens of cars and motorbike events across 4 days. So Elsie Lang went along to check out Warwick's classic Bull Chaser.
Before he became one of Australia's best directors, Warwick Thornton was just a kid from Alice Springs who really loved cars.
Alice Springs as a child, well, you know, as a teenager, you did a fair bit of walking, you know. And then suddenly you left school early and you actually got some cash together and you bought something for $500. Suddenly, if you owned a car, you were somebody.
The Kydich filmmaker has a tongue-in-cheek warning about his entry into this year's Red Centre Nats in Alice Springs.
You probably need a tetanus shot to actually drive it.
But the truth is, the Cannes Film Festival Camera d'Or winner, whose landmark films Samson and Delilah and Sweet Country have cemented him as one of Australia's finest directors, his passion for cars has continued. Finding and buying them, Thornton then spends hours tinkering away in backyards and sheds across Alice Springs until their engines burst to life and roar.
This year, Thornton is making his Red Centre Nats debut with a beast, a heavily modified 1970s Toyota FJ40 bull chaser, rebuilt to chase and catch scrub bulls in the harsh Northern Territory outback. He says cars and filmmaking aren't so different, his car fixation linked to his love of film.
Well, you know, the where they intersect is in storytelling, you know what I mean? And lust and envy and a certain amount of madness in the basis of storytelling. You know, I grew up with cars, so, you know, when I think of, you know, a great movie, obviously there's early Mad Maxes, and obviously there's films like Running on Empty or Corvette Summer or, you know, so many great Australian, well, Corvette Summer was an Australian film, but great Australian films about car culture. And I was watching that even before I thought I'd be a cinematographer, let alone a director.
The Mad Max-esque automobile is by no means Thornton's prettiest car, but it has been a passion project for about 10 years after he and his son, filmmaker Dylan River, brought it back to Alice Springs from the Top End. Bull chasers are stripped down, short-wheel-based four-wheel drives, fitted with heavy bull bars, reinforced steel sides and gutted interiors, made for tearing through rough terrain.
I found it Catherine's side of VRD under a big old mango tree covered in batshit. And the old cocky who owned it, I said, you want to sell that old bull catcher? And he said, it's not a bull catcher, it's a bull chaser. And I said, yeah, but do you want to sell it? And he went, yeah, nah. Anyway, I gave him some money that he was pretty, you know, he didn't smile, but I think he thinks he ripped me off. he was very happy with the amount of money I gave him for this.
In the hulk of rusting metal, Thornton saw the potential to preserve a piece of station history dreamed up out of necessity.
So these things were built to get in there, give them a tap with those tyres on the front, or give them a slap on the ass with that big side plate there, and push them out where there would be a bull catcher waiting that had a huge mechanical arm, push them out, drag them up to the bull catcher, and then the bull catcher put the arm around them. And I have such love and respect for this. This would have been flogged.
Amber Driver, who owns Elkedra Station about 400 kilometres north of Alice Springs, says station workers are still using similar vehicles to muster cattle.
Quite an iconic part of the Central Australian and also Northern Australian cattle industry. While they might look like they're straight out of a Mad Max film, they, you know, offer a lot of practical tools when you're mustering wild cattle or even buffalo.
But unlike most working bull chasers, Thornton and River have installed a shiny new V8 engine in theirs. Red Centre Nats is a sister festival to Canberra's Summer Nats, celebrating all things horsepower with dozens of high-octane events across 4 days, including burnout competitions, drag races, a street parade and even a mullet off. The festival is an economic boon for the town, as more than 50% of the 700 entrants to descend on the Red Centre each year travel from interstate. Festival organiser Andy Lopez says part of the magic is the special permit available across the weekend, which allows motoring enthusiasts driving heavily modified cars that aren't usually allowed on the roads to participate.
In the end, this might sound a bit soppy, but in the end, these vehicles are an outpouring of love. They represent the personality of not just the owner, but the people behind it. And with that comes meaning.
Although Thornton won't be participating in the street parade because the bull chaser doesn't have brakes, he will be parking it up at the Show and Shine for all to see.
And it's gone through every form of technology with welders. So in that way, it's a work of art. Yeah, yeah, it's the Michelangelo of the bush.
If you'd like to see the bull chaser Warwick Thornton was talking about, just search ABC and bull chaser, and you should find Elsie Lang's story on the ABC Car Enthusiasm website. And that's Country Breakfast for this week. I'm David Claughton. Thanks to Kerry Dell for technical production and Callie Buchanan for the Rural News Wrap and Petra Oates for the deep dive into the backpacker visa issue. If you missed something on the show, you can catch up at any time by searching for the Country Breakfast program on the ABC Listen app. You can get more rural news on landline, on ABC TV and on demand through the iView app. And you can search ABC Rural to find a lot of other stories about agriculture and mining. I'm heading off to the desert myself to spend a few weeks around the Flinders, Ranges and Lake Eyre. So I'll catch you after that. Stay with ABC Radio National for the latest conversations and analysis on Australian and world affairs with Nick Bright on Saturday Extra.
You've been listening to an ABC podcast. Discover more great ABC podcasts, live radio, and exclusives on the ABC Listen app.